Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And special greetings to my friend Abdullah Akuji, my 7-year-old friend from Polokwane, and also to Ghulam Hussein Jetam. Right, I'm Abi Dawji, and of course this is the Big Picture Broadcasting on Radio Islam and Radio Al Ansar, your weekly high facts diet of pure unadulterated news analysis. This week I decided to completely ignore the big story that's dominating the headlines all across the world. I won't even mention its name, except to give you a hint that it's about masks, hand sanitizers, and so on. Nope, nothing about that this week. In fact, if I don't speak about that, then there's nothing more to say. Which reminds me of President Cyril Ramaphosa. He gave that big speech this week where he had nothing to say, but still that didn't stop him from saying it. Right, so one more week to go, inshallah, and it's been such a wonderful Ramadan, isn't it? Nice weather, everyone under house arrest, enjoying family life, Fro graphing it out in the kitchen, Bali getting on everyone's nerves, especially if he's paying 100 bucks for his packet of scapes, which he can have after iftar. Also wonderful, ne? A different Ramadan completely. And how is Eid going to be next weekend? That's really going to be very different. It's going to be a video call Eid Mubarak, lockdown Eid. What about those big family get-togethers where aunties and uncles and cousins all meet at the big house, as it's called, the big house? I think it will still happen. There'll be some subterfuge. A sort of Tatama chance gathering. The garage door opens and there's a long driveway, so all the cars will go in and then the door will close and any blue light going past won't see any cars outside the house. So nothing happening there. Or Uncle Yunus will fetch everyone from everywhere and drop them off at the big house. And only his Toyota will be parked outside. So no suspicion that there's a big gathering inside. Hey, did I just give you an idea of evading social gatherings? Yes, sis. I hope they don't come for me for undermining the lockdown. So as you can gather so far, I have nothing much to say this week. So since this is also an educational program, let's see what I've got for you. Okay, here's it. The origin of certain English expressions that we use or things that we do but don't know why we do it. For example, at weddings you will almost always see the bride sitting on the stage and in her hand she has a bouquet of flowers. Did you ever wonder why she holds this bunch of flowers? Well, you'll be quite surprised at the explanation, and here it is. Here are some facts about the 1500, that's the year 1500. Most people got married in June. Because they took their yearly bath in May, and they still smelled pretty good by June. However, since they were starting to smell, brides carried a bouquet of flowers to hide the body odor. Hence the custom today of carrying a bouquet when getting married. I bet you didn't know that. Did you know that? Yeah, that's quite a stinker. And I can imagine the panchayat kalas at the next wedding. We'll be looking at that bouquet and wonder whether the bride had a shower. Bridal shower. Okay, here's another one. I'm sure you must have used this expression quite a few times. Don't throw the baby out with the bath water. Don't throw the baby out with the bath water. So where did that come from? Of course, you don't know. So I'll tell you. Again, we go back a few centuries. Now, baths consisted of a big tub filled with hot water. The man of the house had the privilege of the nice clean water. He goes in first. Then all the other sons and men then the women, and finally the children. Last of all, the babies. By then, the water was so dirty, you could actually lose someone in it. Hence the saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. The water would be so dirty, there'd be a baby inside there, and accidentally you threw it out. So, there you are. That's an explanation. So, now you know. Okay. What about the expression you used many times? Hey, Mamu, it's raining cats and dogs, eh? You always use that expression, it's raining cats and dogs. You never stopped and thought, hey, that doesn't make sense. Or what does it actually mean? Again, we go back centuries. Houses had thatched roofs, thick straw piled very high, with no wood underneath. It was the only place for animals to get warm. So all the cats and other small animals, even mice and bugs, all lived in the roof. When it rained, it became slippery, and sometimes the animal will slip and fall off the roof. Hence the saying, it's raining cats and dogs. So, there you are, folks. Makes sense now, eh? Now to the next one. Someone saying, most of the upper crust lot are living in Amtlanga. So what does that mean, upper crust? Again, we go back for an explanation. Now, centuries ago, bread was divided according to status. Workers got the burnt bottom half of the loaf that was baked. The family got the middle, and the guests got the top, or the upper crust. So, now you know that one also. Okay, let's go for the last one. You must have sometimes used the expression, saved by the bell. Hey, Rashid Bhai got saved by the bell. Cops were parked at the corner, and he just managed to make it to his home 2 minutes before the curfew started. Otherwise, if they stopped him, 5,000 rand fine for breaking the lockdown. He got saved by the bell. Where does that come from? Well, England is old and small, and local folks started running out of places to bury people. So they would dig up coffins and would take the bones to a bone house and reuse the grave. When reopening these coffins, one out of 25 coffins were found to have scratch marks on the inside. And they realized they had been burying people alive. So they would tie a string on the wrist of the corpse, thread it through the coffin and up through the ground and tie it to a bell. Someone would have to sit out in the graveyard all night. That's how you got the word graveyard shift. Someone would have to sit out in the graveyard all night to listen for the bell. Thus, someone could be saved by the bell. And that's the truth. Saved by the bell. If the bell is ringing, that means that guy in the coffin downstairs is still alive. Right. So there you are, folks. Who told you that history is boring? So, when that uncle who talks too much comes to for Eid, as he normally does, this weekend, you can bamboozle him by asking him about the origin of these expressions, eh? Okay, let's get to the serious stuff. Very, very, very serious stuff. You know, for a long time I have heard, and you also have heard repeatedly about the bombings of civilians, Assad dropping bombs on the residential areas, the Israelis firing tank shells into Gaza, Saudi Arabian jets bombing Yemen, and so on. Men, women, and children killed, civilians. We hear this regularly, and we see the carnage on TV. But on Tuesday, I heard the most sickening story. An act of terrorism that left me totally speechless, shocked, disgusted, angry, sad, depressed, outraged, sickened, nauseated, and really, really, really got me thinking about humanity, about the despicable barbarians that live amongst us. Barbarians with not an ounce of goodness, not a drop, just pure evil, bloodthirsty savages, devils in human form. I am not a violent person, as I keep telling you. For me, slaughtering a chicken is a seriously traumatic experience. But I'll tell you this. I would gladly put a rope around the necks of these shaitans, the despicable rats who carried out a most dastardly act of sheer terrorism on Tuesday. What did they do? Listen to this. Listen to this. As armed men rampaged through an Afghan hospital on Tuesday, shooting dead mothers and babies, a group of pregnant women hid in a room with one of them about to give birth. The midwife who delivered the baby and severed the umbilical cord with her bare hands said the mother was in pain, but was trying not to make any sound. She even put her finger in the newborn baby's mouth to stop her from crying. This is what she told the news agency on Friday on the phone. The raid in the maternity ward of Kabul's Mirchi National Hospital left 24 people dead, including newborns, mothers and nurses. There were 26 mothers in the hospital on the morning. Gunmen posing as members of the Afghan security forces burst in, said Doctors Without Borders, which runs the maternity ward. 11 of them were killed during the hours-long attack, including 3 in a delivery room with their newborn babies. 5 others were wounded. At least 6 babies lost their mothers in an attack that sparked international outrage. Another 10 sheltered in safe rooms, which are common in Afghanistan and are often armored to protect the occupants from gunfire or rockets. The midwife, who spoke to the news agency on condition of anonymity, also rushed to one of the safe rooms when the emergency sirens went off. Then one of the women began to give birth, and she says, we helped her with our bare hands. We had nothing else in the room except some toilet paper and our scarves. When the baby was born, we cut the umbilical cord using our hands. We used our headscarf to wrap the baby and the mother. As the terrified women tried to stay quiet, they could hear the gunmen outside asking them to open the door. But we knew they were not security force members. 3 gunmen were later killed by Afghan security forces. After the attack, 18 babies were taken to another hospital for treatment, some of them carried from the scene by heavily armed soldiers. No group has claimed the attack, but the United States has blamed the Islamic State of Iraq and so on. And of course, the Afghan government has blamed the Taliban. Yeah, so dear listeners, tell me if I am wrong in calling these terrorists barbarians. I can't imagine the level of trauma these women felt, and pregnant ones who were in the delivery rooms, the sheer horror of it, the grieving of the husbands and families, absolutely unimaginable, the suffering, the heartache, and the deep sorrow. Attacking a maternity ward, for what? For what? For what? Yes, I won't hesitate for a second to put a rope around their necks and hang them high. Okay, let's just tone down a little. But I think before we do that, we'll have a guest on the line. And the guest on the line is Mustafa Darsot, who is well known to you as a stand-in for me when I'm overseas. He's a political analyst. Mustafa Darsot, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam, brother AB, and assalamu alaikum to all the listeners. How are you doing today?
Alhamdulillah, batteries are all charged up. What about you?
Well, okay, you know, just we got the day 50 today of the lockdown.
Lost track of the days also. Every day seems like a Sunday to me now.
That's true.
Right, so let's get to it. I came across a story about the similarity of actions taken by the Indian government and the Israeli government. Just, can you expand on that?
Okay, AB, look, it's all got to do with, if you have to look at a narrative, it's political expansion and political opportunism at a time of a crisis. And right now we have the global crisis of this pandemic, the COVID-19. And, you've had in the past in history where there was crisis and political expansion and political opportunism struck. For example, before World War II started, Nazi Germany used the opportunity to violate the Treaty of Versailles, which was to, you know, to leave the Rhineland as a buffer zone, you know, in the aftermath of World War I. They violated that treaty, and they then, of course, shortly after that, annexed France. Then you have coming back, you know, fast forward to 2008, when Russia decided to invade Georgia, the world's attention was focused on the Beijing Olympic Games, right? So, and then not so long ago, in January this year, when you had the Trump's assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian army general, right? It was at the same time when Trump's impeachment hearings were taking place, or it was a distraction from his impeachment hearings. So you see, these are all political opportunism and expansion. So you have to unpack this and look at it in that light. And of course, you know, these words that say that never let a crisis go to waste holds true for what's happening currently in Israel and India. With each using the fog of this virus, COVID-19, I mean, we've heard of the term fog of war. Now you've got the fog of the COVID-19 pandemic to expand the respective settler colonial projects, or you want to call it ethnic cleansing over disputed territories, in total defiance of international law, right? Now, just going into what's happening in Israel, you know, from last year, March, Netanyahu was battling to form a coalition government despite winning the election 3 times, but obviously not having a 50% majority, but having the most votes, he was given the chance to form a government, and he failed each time. And in each of these elections, his former army general, Benny Gantz, was his rival and refused to have anything to do with him. And in fact, it was pretty clear that even with the corruption charges that were looming over Netanyahu, that sort of bad blood was made obvious between the two of them. However, what you can say, as you just spoke about what happened in Afghanistan about the umbilical cord, you know, has struck these two, and they suddenly formed an alliance and decided to form a coalition government. And now you've got this Netanyahu-Gantz government that is now in office, and they are working on to formalize the annexation of the West Bank, which is under occupation, right? And they want to pass the bill as early as the 1st of July. Now, and the best part was that U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was there just 2 days ago for the day visit to Israel, giving sort of reason that this must be done in accordance with the U.S. peace plan, basically telling them, do what you want to, because his reaction and what he's telling reporters is that this is an Israeli decision, okay? And then you have the a council from, a council head from the Yesha Council, the name of David Eliani, who says that we called on all elected members from the national parties to stand behind this legislation to advance sovereignty and prevent the creation of a Palestinian state. So they're very brazen about it, and they say that they want to, you know, they're in the sudden haste to annex the stolen Palestinian land, right, believe that the international community is too distracted with this COVID-19 virus, and so much so that people are not in the mood to or don't care to protest because of, you know, all sorts of things. And then, of course, you have the presidential race there that's happening for the November 2020 elections between Biden and Trump, and there's got these, you know, these margin differences, but this is all, you know, by the way, because at the end of the day, they will still, no matter who comes into the U.S. office, they will still support Israel's actions. One may just be milder than the other, but at the end of the day, they all achieve the same thing. And then you've got Naftali Bennett, the defense minister, you know, who regards Palestinians as animals, and he was on his Twitter account to say that the building momentum in the country must not be stopped for even a second. Now, what he meant is that what we're trying to do in order to annex the West Bank. And he was referring to the government's decision that authorized the construction of 7,000 additional housing units in the area of Efrat. And this is a total war crime, because this is now on Palestinian territory. It's there to deny them the statehood, and it is in total violation of international law. And, you know, what Saeed Arakat has to say about this was that Trump administration's and administration's plan endorses everything that's illegal. Israeli colonial settlement enterprise is about a racist narrative, violations of international law, and the perpetuation of the denial of Palestinian rights. Now, go a few countries to the east, and then you have India. From we all know that what India did last year in August when they abrogated Articles 370 and 35A of the sovereignty of Kashmir, and now that we have that Kashmir is now a formally occupied state, as before they had some sort of semi-autonomy, but now it's a formally occupied state of India. You have 9 million people that are living in Jammu Kashmir, and you've got 900,000 Indian troops. So you've got one soldier for every 10 individuals in Kashmir who are basically enforcing the law and ruling over the lives with total impunity. Right? Delhi recently passed a law also last month that sets out new laws for Kashmir, including domicile rights for Indian citizens. Now, what happened in the past, under the old articles, only Kashmiri citizens were allowed to own land in Kashmir. Right? Now this new law allows any Indian citizen to come in there and own land. So given that there's 900,000 soldiers in Kashmir, and they've also got this, you know, they will now want to obviously purchase land, which the government will help them to do, own the property, and they'll allow to bring their families, okay, especially those, and they have been there for 15 years or more. So what is this? This is ethnic cleansing. And it's no secret by now that the government of the BJP wishes to do to Kashmir what Israel has done to the Palestinian territories, according to a school teacher in Srinagar. Right? Giving land, homes and jobs to Indian soldiers and their families, how India will try and change the demographics here. No different to what Israel has done with its settlers in the West Bank. And they're calling this the perfect crime. Because this is what they say, Delhi's motive is to facilitate and encourage democratic flooding, or rather make the Muslim majority state into a minority and kill any chance of a future independent Kashmiri state. This is the same way that Israel is behaving towards the Palestinians by killing any chance of the Palestinian state that one wants to see. And already they have migrated 1 million Jewish settlers into the occupied territories in the West Bank. Now, if one has to murder the Israeli model, right, India will predictably turn military outposts into small settlements into large settlements, and then large settlements into small cities, complete with shopping centers, schools, recreational facilities, and 24-hour military-backed security. Right? And India doesn't stop there. They have been up in the ante in Kashmir by escalating its military activities in Kashmir since the COVID pandemic began, including moving of heavy military artillery into residential neighborhoods and villages to use it as a base for which to target Pakistani military locations from its bunker position. So in other words, what they're trying to do is they're using the civilians in these areas as human shields so that they can deter Pakistani counter-military strikes. And this has been having a negative effect on the residents because they say that whenever shots are fired from this heavy artillery, the houses, the contents of the houses shake, children's ears get affected with the deafness. You know, there's obviously sends, you know, everybody into panic mode. So, you know, stress levels go high. So it's just a ripple effect that that's going to obviously get out of hand. And the best part is the international community will do nothing because they are preoccupied with what's happening right now. And it's not only there. Look at other countries that are also using this. For example, China.
We're just going to leave it there for the time being, Mustafa Dasar, showing us the similarities between the colonization that's taking place in India of Kashmir and also of the West Bank by Israel. Mustafa Dasar, Jazakallah for focusing on that particular area.
Okay, fine, no problem. We'll talk again, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.
JazakAllah for your input. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Well, all right, let's just tone down a little bit and look at another story. Shame, man. Saudi Arabia is in real trouble. it's just been announced that VAT has been increased from 5% to 15%. Oil prices have dropped dramatically, as you know, and they all have a lockdown. And I told you last week that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has blessed many of the Muslim lands with a precious commodity, oil, that the whole world needs. It pours out of the ground, you fill it up into barrels and sell it like hotcakes. Oil was discovered in Saudi Arabia in 1933, and since then dollars have been flooding in like a tsunami. And the royal family has been spending it as fast as it comes in. But shame, man, now the people are struggling. Things are now more expensive in Saudi Arabia than in South Africa, or so I heard. And how the royal family must be suffering, eh? They must be really, I feel sad for them. Especially the new kid on the block, Mohammed bin Salman, as he is referred to by his nickname, MBS, Master of Bull, I don't know what the S can stand for, I'll leave that to you. So, how broke is the royal family and MBS? Here's something that will give you an idea. The monarchy, the royal family, is said to be worth more than £1 trillion. That is around 22 trillion rands. I don't even know how many zeros there. More than 16 times the wealth of the British royal family. And with that amount of cash, the royal family expect only the best. Private jets, luxury super yachts, helicopters, palaces, luxury chateaus, gold furniture in their lavish homes, and even a gold-plated tissue dispenser. Gold-plated tissue dispenser. Among one of the biggest spenders in the royal family is Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. On one wall in one of his Saudi Arabian royal palaces hangs a Leonardo da Vinci painting worth, how much? He's got a painting of Leonardo da Vinci worth £360 million. Now, I won't try to say that in Zuma speak, but just try to imagine 7,920 million rands. 7,920 million rands. The Crown Prince, who is the heir to the throne, is also said to have bought a £400 million. Again, that translates to 8,800 million rands. And that's what he paid for a super yacht. And he paid £240 million, that's 5,280 million rands, for a chateau in France, two homes in London, and an entire compound on the southern coast of Spain. Amongst its many impressive features of this chateau are an in-house aquarium, indoor and outdoor swimming pools, and a nightclub. The chateau also contains 10 bedroom suites, a library, private squash court, a cinema room, two ballrooms, and a wine cellar which can hold up to 3,000 bottles. And many of the amenities can be controlled by an iPhone, including fountains, sound system, lights, and air conditioning. In an interview with CBS News, the Crown Prince insisted that his finances were a private matter. And this is what he said, "I'm a rich person and not a poor person. I'm not Gandhi or Mandela. I'm a member of the ruling family that existed for hundreds of years before the founding of Saudi Arabia." His father, the king, who came to the throne in 2015, is believed to have a personal fortune of £13.5 billion, which is, in our money, 297 billion rands. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia is on the verge of completing a whopping £300 million takeover of Newcastle United Football Club. Huh? That's 6,600 million rands. 6,600 million rands. I won't translate that into trillions. But the deal may not go through because it has been found that Saudi Arabia has been selling decoders to people and pirating all the football matches that have been played, professional football that has been played in the UK. So that might be scuttled. I don't have time to tell you about the NEOM, which is this big city that is planned at an estimated cost of $500 billion. That project may also sink. There's a whole lot of stories around that. And the poor Saudis, and sales tax have gone up to 15%. And of course, for the last 4 years, they have been bombing Yemen. And the cost of that has been, well, they have mercenaries that are fighting there. And the cost of that has been $200 million per day. That's what it's been costing them. Anyway, this royal family and MBS really take the cake. And let me tell you about another cake whose country is rich in oil. His name is Hassan al-Bolkiah. Hassan al-Bolkiah is the Sultan of Brunei, a small Islamic nation on the island of Borneo in southeastern Asia. The 73-year-old Sultan became a crown prince at the age of 15 in 1961 and was crowned Brunei's 29th Sultan in August 1968. Sultan Hassan al-Bolkiah's net worth as of April 2020 is $25 billion. That's about 500 billion rands. One of the wealthiest, according to Forbes magazine. Brunei, the country of Brunei, formally gained independence from UK in 1984. And to mark this occasion, Bolkiah needed to do something that would leave a landmark. That's why he commissioned a palace called Istana Nurul Imam, which cost $600 million. And it has a garage for space for 800 cars. Around the same time, Bolkiah paid $70 million for an oil painting. This guy like oil painting. That's 1,400 million rands. 1,400 million for an oil painting. Young Girls at the Piano by French painter Pierre-Auguste Renoir. The Sultan has a strikingly lavish craving for automobiles. He likes cars, this guy. And he has 500 Rolls Royces and he shares a collection of 5,000 cars with his brother Prince Jeffrey. During the 1990s, the Sultan's family reportedly accounted for almost half of all Rolls Royces purchased in the world. Bolkiah owns more cars with a combined worth of $4 billion, which includes 500 Rolls Royces. His fleets of cars would include Lamborghini, Murcielago, LP640, a Bentley Continental, Ferrari, a Mythos concept car, both Ferrari 456 GT sedans, the only right-hand drive Mercedes-Benz CLK GTR in the world, and 5 McLaren F1s. The Sultan has a customized gold Rolls Royce called the Golden Royal Rolls Royce. It's designed with an open top and a... You know, let me just tell you something, because we're running out of time. Oh, by the way, one quick one. Even as he aged, he did not really give up an excessive spending habit, as he often... He often spends $20,000. $20,000 for a single haircut. Bolkiah flies out his favorite barber from London, according to the Times newspaper. And this barber, he works at the Dutch